food for it on the last day's journey, as the grasses and ferns of the forest had been replaced by grey rocks and stunted thorn bushes. The unicorn's unshod hooves were not meant for the rocky road, nor was its back meant to carry riders, and its pace became slower and slower. As they travelled, the star cursed the day she had fallen to this wet, unfriendly world. It had seemed so gentle and welcoming when seen from high in the sky. That was before. Now she hated everything about it, except the unicorn. And, saddle sore and uncomfortable, she would have even happily spent time away from the unicorn. After a day of pelting rain, the lights of the inn were the most welcoming sight she had seen in her time on the earth. "Watch your step, watch your step," pattered the raindrops on the stone. The unicorn stopped 50 yards from the inn and would approach no closer. The door to the inn was opened, flooding the grey world with warm yellow light. "Hello there, dearie," called a welcoming voice from the open doorway. The star stroked the unicorn's wet neck and spoke softly to the animal, but it made no move, stood there frozen in the light of the inn like a pale ghost. "Will you be coming in, dearie, or will you be stopping out there in the rain?" The woman's friendly voice warmed the star, soothed her, just the right mixture of practicality and concern. "We can get you food, if it's food you're after. There's a fire blazing in the hearth, and enough hot water for a tub that'll melt the chill from your bones."
I will need help coming in," said the star. "My leg."
"Ah, poor mite," said the woman. "I'll have my husband Billy carry you inside. There's hay and fresh water in the stables for your beast." The unicorn looked about wildly as the woman approached. "There, there, dearie. I won't be coming too close. After all, it's been many a long year since I was maiden enough to touch a unicorn, and many a long year since such a one was seen in these parts." Nervously, the unicorn followed the woman into the stables, keeping its distance from her. It walked along the stable to the furthest stall, where it lay down in the dry straw, and the star scrambled off its back, dripping and miserable. Billy turned out to be a white-bearded, gruff sort of fellow. He said little, but carried the star into the inn and put her down on a 3-legged stool in front of a crackling log fire. "Poor dear," said the innkeeper's wife, who had followed them inside. "Look at you, wet as a water nixie. Look at the puddle under you in your lovely dress. Oh, the state of it, you must be soaked to the bone." And, sending her husband away, she helped the star remove her dripping wet dress, which she placed on a hook near the fire, where each drip hissed and fizzed when it fell to the hot bricks of the hearth. There was a tin tub in front of the fire, and the innkeeper's wife put up a paper screen around it. "How'd you like your baths?" she asked solicitously. "Warm, hot, or boil a lobster?"
"I do not know," said the star, naked, but for the topaz stone on the silver chain about her waist, her head all in a whirl at the strange turn that events had taken. "For I have never had a bath before."
"Never had one?" The innkeeper's wife looked astonished. "Why, you poor duck! Well, we won't make it too hot, then. Call me if you need another copperful of water. I've got some going over the kitchen fire, and when you're done with the bath, I'll bring you some mulled wine and some sweet roasted turnips."
And before the star could protest that she neither ate nor drank, the woman had bustled off, leaving the star sitting in the tin tub, a broken leg in its splints, sticking out of the water and resting on the 3-legged stool. Initially, the water was indeed too hot, but as she became used to the heat, she relaxed and was, for the first time since she had tumbled from the sky, utterly happy. "There's a love," said the innkeeper's wife, returning. "How are you feeling now?"
"Much, much better, thank you," said the star. "And your heart? How does your heart feel?" asked the woman.
"My heart?" It was a strange question, but the woman seemed genuinely concerned.
"It feels happier,
more easy, less troubled. Good. That's good. Let us get it burning high and hot within you, eh? Burning bright inside you. I am sure that under your care, my heart shall blaze and burn with happiness, said the star. The innkeeper's wife leaned over and chucked the star under the chin. There's a pet, such a duck it is, the fine things it says. And the woman smiled indulgently and ran a hand through her grey-streaked hair. She hung a thick toweling robe on the edge of the screen. This is for you to wear when you are done with your bath. Oh, no, not to hurry, ducks. It'll be nice and warm for you, and your pretty dress will still be damp for a while now. Just give us a shout when you want to hop out of the tub, and I'll come and give you a hand. Then she leaned over and touched the star's chest between her breasts with one cold finger, and she smiled. A good, strong heart, she said. There were good people on this benighted world, the star decided, warmed and contented. Outside, the rain and the wind pattered and howled through the mountain pass. But in the inn, at the sign of the chariot, all was warm and comfortable. Eventually, the innkeeper's wife, assisted by her dull-faced daughter, helped the star out of her bath. The firelight glinted on the topaz set in silver, which the star wore on a knotted silver chain about her waist, until the topaz and the star's body vanished beneath the thick toweling of her robe. "Now, my sweet," said the innkeeper's wife, "you come over here and make yourself comfortable." She helped the star over to a long wooden table, at the head of which were laid a cleaver and a knife, both of them with hilts of bone and blades of dark glass. Leaning and limping, the star made it to the table and sat down at the bench beside it. Outside there was a gust of wind, and the fire flared up green and blue and white. Then a deep voice boomed from outside the inn over the howl of the elements.
"Service! Food! Wine! Fire! Where is the stable boy?"
Billy the innkeeper and his daughter made no move, but only looked at the woman in the red dress, as if for instructions. She pursed her lips, and then she said, "It can wait for a little. After all, you are not going anywhere, my dearie," this last to the star. "Not on that leg of yours, and not until the rain lets up, eh? I appreciate your hospitality more than I can say," said the star, simply and with feeling. "Of course you do," said the woman in the red dress, and her fidgeting fingers brushed the black knives impatiently, as if there was something she could not wait to be doing. "Plenty of time when these nuisances have gone, eh?" The light of the inn was the happiest and best thing Tristram had seen on his journey through Faerie. While Primus bellowed for assistance, Tristram unhitched the exhausted horses and led them one by one into the stables on the side of the inn. There was a white horse asleep in the furthest stall, but Tristram was too busy to pause to inspect it. He knew, somewhere in the odd place inside him, that new directions and distances of things he had never seen and the places he had never been, that the star was close at hand, and this comforted him and made him nervous. He knew that the horses were more exhausted and more hungry than he was. His dinner, and thus, he suspected, his confrontation with the star, could wait. "I'll groom the horses," he told Primus. "They'll catch a chill otherwise." The tall man rested his huge hand on Tristram's shoulder.
"Good lad, I'll send a potboy out with some burnt ale for you."
Tristram thought about the star as he brushed down the horses and picked out their hooves. What would he say? What would she say? He was brushing the last of the horses when a blank-looking pot girl came out to him with a tankard of steaming wine. "Put it down over there," he told her. "I'll drink it with goodwill as soon as my hands are free." She put it down on the top of a tack box and went out without saying anything. It was then that the horse in the end stall got to its feet and began to kick against the door.
"Settle down there," called Tristram. "Settle down, fellow, and I'll see if I cannot find warm oats and bran for all of you."
There was a large stone in the stallion's front inside hoof, and Tristram removed it with care. "Madam," he had decided he would say, "please accept my heartfelt and most humble apologies."
"Sir," the star would say in her turn, "that I shall do with all my heart. Now let us go to your village, where you shall present me to your true love as a token of your devotion to her."
His ruminations were interrupted by an enormous clattering, as a huge white horse, but he realized immediately it was not a horse, kicked down the door of its stall and came charging desperately toward him, its horn lowered. Tristram threw himself onto the straw on the stable floor, his arms about his head. Moments passed. He raised his head. The unicorn had stopped in front of the tankard, was lowering its horn into the mulled wine. Awkwardly, Tristram got to his feet. The wine was steaming and bubbling, and it came to Tristram then, the information surfacing from some long-forgotten fairy tale or piece of children's lore, that a unicorn's horn was proof against... "Poison?" he whispered, and the unicorn raised its head and stared into Tristram's eyes, and Tristram knew that it was the truth. His heart was pounding hard in his chest. Around the inn, the wind was screaming like a witch in her madness. Tristram ran to the stable door, and he stopped and thought. He fumbled in his tunic pocket, finding the lump of wax, which was all that remained of his candle, with a dried copper leaf sticking to it. He peeled the leaf away from the wax with care. Then he raised the leaf to his ear and listened to what it told him.
"Wine, my lord?"
asked the middle-aged woman in the long red dress, when Primus had entered the inn.
"I am afraid not," he said. "I have a personal superstition that, until the day I see my brother's corpse cold on the ground before me, I shall drink only my own wine, and eat only food I have obtained and prepared myself. This I shall do here, if you have no objection. I shall, of course, pay you as if it were your own wine I was drinking. If I might trouble you to put this bottle of mine near the fire to take the chill from it. Now, I have a companion on my journey, a young man who is attending to the horses. He has sworn no such oath, and I am sure that if you could send him a mug of burnt ale, it would help take the chill from his bones." The potmaid bobbed a curtsy, and she scuttled back to the kitchens. "So, mine host," said Primus to the white-bearded innkeeper, "how are your beds here at the back of beyond? Have you straw mattresses? Are there fires in the bedrooms? And I note with increasing pleasure that there is a bathtub in front of your fireplace. If there's a fresh copper of steaming water, I shall have a bath later. But I shall pay you no more than a small silver coin for it, mind."
The innkeeper looked to his wife, who said, "Our beds are good, and I shall have the maid make up a fire in the bedroom for you and your companion." Primus removed his dripping black robe and hung it by the fire, beside the star's still damp blue dress. Then he turned and saw the young lady sitting at the table.
"Another guest," he said. "Well met, milady, in this noxious weather."
At that, there was a loud clattering from the stable next door.
"Something must have disturbed the horses," said Primus, concerned.
"Perhaps the thunder," said the innkeeper's wife.
"Aye, perhaps,"
said Primus. Something else was occupying his attention. He walked over to the star and stared into her eyes for several heartbeats.
"You?" he hesitated. Then with certainty, "you have my father's stone. You have the power of Stormhold."
The girl glared up at him with eyes the blue of sky.
"Well then," she said, "ask me for it, and I can have done with the stupid thing."
The innkeeper's wife hurried over and stood at the head of the table.
"I'll not have you bothering the other guests now, my dearie ducks," she told him sternly.
Primus's eyes fell upon the knives upon the wood of the tabletop. He recognized them. There were tattered scrolls in the vaults of Stormhold, in which those knives were pictured and the names were given. They were old things from the first age of the world. The front door of the inn banged open.
"Primus!" called Tristram, running in. "They have tried to poison me!"
The Lord Primus reached for his short sword, but even as he went for it, the Witch Queen took the longest of the knives and drew the blade of it in one smooth, practical movement across his throat. For Tristram, it all happened too fast to follow. He entered, saw the Star and Lord Primus and the innkeeper and his strange family, and then the blood was spurting in a crimson fountain in the firelight.
"Get him!" called the woman in the scarlet dress. "Get the brat!"
Billy and the maid ran toward Tristram, and it was then that the unicorn entered the inn. Tristram threw himself out of the way. The unicorn reared up on its hind legs, and a blow from one of its sharp hooves sent the potmaid flying. Billy lowered his head and ran headlong at the unicorn, as if he were about to butt it with his forehead. The unicorn lowered its head also, and Billy the innkeeper met his unfortunate end.
"Stupid!" screamed the innkeeper's wife furiously, and she advanced upon the unicorn, a knife in each hand, blood staining her right hand and forearm the same color as her dress.
Tristram had thrown himself onto his hands and knees and had crawled toward the fireplace. In his left hand, he had hold of the lump of wax, all that remained of the candle that had brought him here. He'd been squeezing it in his hand until it was soft and malleable. "This had better ought to work," said Tristram to himself. He hoped that the tree had known what she was talking about. Behind him, the unicorn screamed in pain. Tristram ripped a lace from his jerkin and closed the wax around it.
"What is happening?"
asked the Star, who had crawled toward Tristram on her hands and knees.
"I don't really know," he admitted.
The witch woman howled then. The unicorn had speared her with its horn through the shoulder. It lifted her off the ground triumphantly, preparing to hurl her to the ground and then to dash her to death beneath its sharp hooves, when, impaled as she was, the witch woman swung around and thrust the point of the longer of the rock-glass knives into the unicorn's eye and far into its skull. The beast dropped to the wooden floor of the inn, blood dripping from its side and from its eye and from its open mouth. First it fell to its knees, and then it collapsed utterly as the life fled. Its tongue was piebald, and it protruded most pathetically from the unicorn's dead mouth. The witch queen pulled her body from the horn, and, one hand gripping her wounded shoulder, the other holding her cleaver, she staggered to her feet. Her eyes scanned the room, alighting on Tristram and the Star huddled by the fire. Slowly, agonizingly slowly, she lurched toward them, a cleaver in her hand and a smile upon her face. "The burning golden heart of a star at peace is so much finer than the flickering heart of a little frightened star," she told them, her voice oddly calm and detached, coming, as it was, from that blood-bespattered face. "But even the heart of a star who is afraid and scared is better by far than no heart at all." Tristram took the Star's hand in his right hand.
"Stand up," he told her.
"I cannot," she said simply.
"Stand or we die now," he told her,
getting to his feet. The Star nodded and, awkwardly resting her weight on him, she began to try to pull herself to her feet.
"Stand or you die now," echoed the Witch Queen.
"Oh, you die now, children, standing or sitting. It is all the same to me."
She took another step toward them.
"Now,"
said Tristram, one hand gripping the Star's arm, the other holding his makeshift candle.
"Now walk!"
And he thrust his left hand into the fire. There was pain and burning, such that he could have screamed, and the Witch Queen stared at him as if he were madness personified. Then his improvised wick caught and burned with a steady blue flame, and the world began to shimmer around them.
"Please walk," he begged the Star. "Don't let go of me."
And she took an awkward step. They left the inn behind them, the howls of the Witch Queen ringing in their ears. They were underground, and the candlelight flickered from the wet cave walls. And with their next halting step, they were in a desert of white sand, in the moonlight. And with their third step, they were high above the earth, looking down on the hills and trees and rivers far below them. And it was then that the last of the wax ran molten over Tristram's hand, and the burning became impossible for him to bear, and the last of the flame burned out forever. Chapter 8, which treats of castles in the air and other matters. It was dawn in the mountains. The storms of the last few days had passed on, and the air was clean and cold. Lord Septimus of Stormhold, tall and crow-like, walked up the mountain pass, looking about him as he walked as if he were seeking something he had lost. He was leading a brown mountain pony, shaggy and small. Where the pass grew wider, he stopped, as if he had found what he was looking for beside the trail. It was a small, battered chariot, little more than a goat cart, which had been tipped onto its side. Nearby it lay two bodies. The first was that of a white billy goat, its head stained red with blood. Septimus prodded the dead goat experimentally with his foot, moving its head. It had received a deep and fatal wound to its forehead, equidistant between its horns. Next to the goat was the body of a young man, his face as dull in death as it must have been in life. There were no wounds to show how he had died, nothing but a leaden bruise upon his temple. Several yards away from these bodies, half hidden beside a rock, Septimus came upon the corpse of a man in his middle years, face down, dressed in dark clothes. The man's flesh was pale, and his blood had pooled upon the rocky floor below him. Septimus crouched down beside the body and gingerly lifted its head by the hair. Its throat had been cut, expertly, slit from one ear to the other. Septimus stared at the corpse in puzzlement. He knew it, yet... And then in a dry, hacking cough of a noise, he began to laugh. "Your beard," he told the corpse aloud. "You cut your beard. As if I would not have known you, with your beard gone, Primus." Primus, who stood, grey and ghostly, beside his other brothers, said, "You would have known me, Septimus, but it might have bought me a few moments wherein I might have seen you before you knew me." And his dead voice was nothing but the morning breeze rattling the thorn bush. Septimus stood up. The sun began to rise then over the easternmost peak of Mount Belly, framing him in light. "So I am to be the 82nd Lord of the Stormhold," he said to the corpse on the ground, and to himself. "Not to mention the Master of the High Crags, Seneschal of the Spire Towns, Keeper of the Citadel, Lord High Guardian of Mount Huon, and all the rest of it." "Not without the power of Stormhold about your neck, you're not, my brother," said Quintus, tartly. "And then there's the matter of revenge," said Secundus, in the voice of the wind howling through the pass. "You must take revenge upon your brother's killer before anything else now. It's blood law." As if he had heard them, Septimus shook his head. "Why could you not have waited just a few more days, Brother Primus?" he asked the corpse at his feet. "I would have killed you myself. I had a fine plan for your death. When I discovered you were no longer on the heart of a dream, it took me little enough time to steal the ship's boat and get on your trail. And now I must revenge your sad carcass, and all for the honor of our blood in the Stormhold." "So Septimus will be the 82nd Lord of Stormhold," said Tertius. "There is a proverbial saying, chiefly concerned with warning against too closely calculating the numerical value of unhatched chicks," pointed out Quintus. Septimus walked away from the body to piss against a grey boulder. Then he walked back to Primus's corpse. "If I had killed you, I could leave you here to rot," he said. "But because that pleasure was another's,
I shall carry you with me a little way and leave you on a high crag to be eaten by eagles.
With that, grunting with the effort, he picked up the sticky-fronted body and hauled it over the back of the pony. He fumbled at the corpse's belt, removing the bag of runestones.
"Thank you for these, my brother," he said, and he patted the corpse on the back. "May you choke on them if you do not take revenge on the bitch who slit my gullet," said Primus, in the voice of the mountain birds, waking to greet the new day.
They sat side by side on a thick, white cumulus cloud the size of a small town. The cloud was soft beneath them and a little cold. It became colder the deeper into it one sank, and Tristram pushed his burned hand as far as he could down into the fabric of it. It resisted him slightly, but accepted his hand. The interior of the cloud felt spongy and chilly, real and insubstantial at once. The cloud cooled a little of the pain in his hand, allowing him to think more clearly.
"Well," he said, after some time, "I'm afraid I've made rather a mess of everything."
The star sat on a cloud beside him, wearing the robe she had borrowed from the woman in the inn, with her broken leg stretched out on the thick mist in front of her.
"You saved my life," she said eventually. "Didn't you?"
"I suppose I must have done, yes."
"I hate you," she said. "I hated you for everything already, but now I hate you most of all."
Tristram flexed his burned hand in the blessed cool of the cloud. He felt tired and slightly faint.
"Any particular reason?"
"Because," she told him, her voice taut, "now that you have saved my life, you are, by the law of my people, responsible for me, and I for you. Where you go, I must also go."
"Oh," he said, "well, that's not that bad, is it? I would rather spend my days chained to a vile wolf or a stinking pig or a marsh goblin," she told him flatly. "I'm honestly not that bad," he told her. "Not when you get to know me. Look, I'm sorry about all that chaining you up business. Perhaps we could start all over again, just pretend it never happened. Here now, my name's Tristram Thorne, pleased to meet you."
He held out his unburned hand to her.
"Mother Moon, defend me," said the star. "I would sooner take the hand of an..."
"I'm sure you would," said Tristram, not waiting to find out what he was going to be unflatteringly compared to this time. "I've said I'm sorry," he told her. "Let's start afresh. I'm Tristram Thorne, pleased to meet you." She sighed. The air was thin and chill so high above the ground, but the sun was warm and the cloud shapes above them reminded Tristram of a fantastical city or an unearthly town. Far, far below, he could see the real world, the sunlight pricking out every tiny tree, turning every winding river into a thin silver snail trail, glistening and looping across the landscape of faery.
"Well," said Tristram.
"Aye," said the star. "It is a mighty joke, is it not? Whither thou goest, there I must go, even if it kills me." She swirled the surface of the cloud with her hand, rippling the mist. Then, momentarily, she touched her hand to Tristram's.
"My sisters called me Yvain," she told him, "for I was an evening star."
"Look at us," he said. "A fine pair. You with your broken leg, me with my hand."
"Show me your hand."
He pulled it from the cool of the cloud. His hand was red, and blisters were coming up on each side of it, and on the back of it where the flames had licked against his flesh.
"Does it hurt?" she asked.
"Yes," he said. "Quite a lot, really."
"Good," said Yvain. "If my hand had not been burned, you would probably be dead now," he pointed out.
She had the grace to look down, ashamed.
"You know," he added, changing the subject, "I left my bag in that madwoman's inn. We have nothing now save the clothes we stand up in."
"Sit down in," corrected the star.
"There's no food, no water. We're half a mile or so above the world, with no way of getting down, and no control over where the cloud is going, and both of us are injured."
Did I leave anything out? You forgot the bit about clouds dissipating and vanishing into nothing, said Yvain. They do that. I've seen them. I could not survive another fall.
Tristram shrugged.
Well, he said, we're probably doomed then. But we may as well have a look around while we're up here.
He helped Yvain to her feet, and awkwardly the two of them took several faltering steps on the cloud. Then Yvain sat down again.
This is no use, she told him. You go and look around. I'll wait here for you.
Promise? He asked.
No running away this time?
I swear it. On my mother, the moon, I swear it, said Yvain sadly.
You saved my life. And with that, Tristram had to content himself.
Her hair was mostly grey now, and her face was pouched and wrinkled at the throat and eyes and at the corners of the mouth. There was no colour to her face, although her skirt was a vivid, bloody splash of scarlet. It had been ripped at the shoulder, and beneath the rip could be seen, puckered and obscene, a deep scar. The wind whipped her hair about her face as she drove the black carriage on through the barrens. The four stallions stumbled often. Thick sweat dripped from their flanks, and a bloody foam dripped from their lips. Still their hooves pounded along the muddy path through the barrens where nothing grows. The Witch Queen, oldest of the Lilim, reined in the horses beside a pinnacle of rock the colour of verdigris, which jutted from the marshy soil of the barrens like a needle. Then, as slowly as might be expected from any lady, no longer in her first or even her second youth, she climbed down from the driver's seat to the wet earth. She walked around the coach and opened the door. The head of the dead unicorn, her dagger still in its cold eye socket, flopped down as she did so. The witch clambered up into the coach and pulled open the unicorn's mouth. Rigor mortis was starting to set in, and the jaw opened only with difficulty. The witch woman bit down hard on her own tongue, bit hard enough that the pain was metal-sharp in her mouth, bit down until she could taste the blood. She swirled it around in her mouth, mixing the blood with spittle. She could feel that several of her front teeth were beginning to come loose. Then she spat onto the dead unicorn's piebald tongue. Blood flecked her lips and chin. She grunted several syllables that shall not be recorded here, then pushed the unicorn's mouth closed once more. Get out of the coach, she told the dead beast. Stiffly, awkwardly, the unicorn raised its head. Then it moved its legs, like a newborn foal or fawn just learning to walk, and twitched and pushed itself up onto all fours, and half climbing, half falling, it tumbled out of the carriage door and onto the mud, where it raised itself to its feet. Its left side, upon which it had lain in the coach, was swollen and dark with blood and fluids. Half blind, the dead unicorn stumbled toward the green rock needle until it reached a depression at its base, where it dropped to the knees of its forelegs in a ghastly parody of prayer. The witch queen reached down and pulled her knife from out of the beast's eye socket. She sliced across its throat. Blood began to ooze, too slowly, from the gash she had made. She walked back to the carriage and returned with her cleaver. Then she began to hack at the unicorn's neck until she had separated it from the body, and the severed head tumbled into the rock hollow, now filling with a dark red puddle of brackish blood. She took the unicorn's head by the horn and placed it beside the body on the rock. Thereupon she looked with her hard grey eyes into the red pool she had made. Two faces stared out at her from the puddle, two women, older by far in appearance than she was now.
"Where is she?"
asked the first face, peevishly.
"What have you done with her?"
"Look at you," said the second of the Lilim.
"You took the last of the youth we had saved. I tore it from the star's breast myself long, long ago, though she screamed and writhed and carried on ever so. From the looks of you, you've squandered most of the youth already."
"I came so close," said the witch woman to her sisters in the pool. "But she had a unicorn to protect her. Now I have the unicorn's head, and I will bring it back with me, for it's long enough since we had fresh ground unicorn's horn in our arts."
Unicorn's horn be damned, said her youngest sister. What about the star?
I cannot find her. It is almost as if she were no longer in fairy. There was a pause.
No, said one of her sisters. She is still in fairy, but she is going to the market at Wall, and that is too close to the world on the other side of the wall, and once she goes into that world, she will be lost to us.
For they each of them knew that were the star to cross the wall and enter the world of things as they are, she would become, in an instant, no more than a pitted lump of metallic rock that had fallen once from the heavens, cold and dead, and of no more use to them.
Then I shall go to Diggory's Dyke and wait there, for all who go to Wall must pass that way.
The reflections of the two old women gazed disapprovingly out of the pool. The witch queen ran her tongue over her teeth. That one at the top will be out by nightfall, she thought, the way it wobbles so. And then she spat into the bloody pool. The ripples spread across it, erasing all traces of the Lilim. Now the pool reflected only the sky over the barrens and the faint white clouds far above them. She kicked the headless corpse of the unicorn, so it tumbled over onto its side. Then she took up its head, and she carried it with her to the driver's seat. She placed it beside her, picked up the reins, and whipped the restive horses into a tired trot. Tristram sat at the top of the spire of cloud and wondered why none of the heroes of the penny dreadfuls he used to read so avidly were ever hungry. His stomach rumbled and his hand hurt him so. Adventures are all very well in their place, he thought, but there's a lot to be said for regular meals and freedom from pain. Still, he was alive, and the wind was in his hair, and the cloud was scudding through the sky like a galleon at full sail. Looking out over the world from above, he could never remember feeling so alive as he did at that moment. There was a skyness to the sky and a nowness to the world that he'd never seen or felt or realized before. He understood that he was, in some way, above his problems, just as he was above the world. The pain in his hand was a long way away. He thought about his actions and his adventures and about the journey ahead of him, and it seemed to Tristram that the whole business was suddenly very small and very straightforward. He stood up on the cloud spire and called, "Hello!" several times, as loudly as he could. He even waved his tunic over his head, feeling a little foolish as he did so. Then he clambered down the spire. 10 feet from the bottom, he missed his footing and fell into the misty softness of the cloud.
"What were you shouting about?" asked Yvain.
"To let people know we were here," Tristram told her.
"What people?"
"Oh, you never know," he told her.
"Better I should call to people who aren't there than that people who are there should miss us, because I didn't say anything."
She said nothing in reply to this.
"I've been thinking," said Tristram, "and what I've been thinking is this. After we're done with what I need, got you back to Wall, given you to Victoria Forrester, perhaps we could do what you need."
"What I need?"
"Well, you want to go back, don't you? Up into the sky, to shine again at night. So we can sort that out."
She looked up at him and shook her head. "That doesn't happen," she explained. "Stars fall. They don't go back up again."
"You could be the first," he told her. "You have to believe, otherwise it will never happen."
"It will never happen," she told him.
"No more than your shouting is going to attract anyone up here where there isn't anyone. It doesn't matter if I believe it or not. That's just the way things are. How's your hand?"
He shrugged.
"Hurts," he said.
"How's your leg?"
"Hurts," she said. "But not as badly as it did before."
"Ahoy!" came a voice from far above them. "Ahoy down there! Party's in need of assistance."
Glinting golden in the sunlight was a small ship, its sails billowing, and a ruddy, mustachioed face looked down at them from over the side.
Was that you, young fellow lad, a-leaping and cavorting just now?
It was, said Tristram. And I think we are in need of assistance, yes.
Right-ho, said the man. Get ready to grab the ladder, then.
I'm afraid my friend has a broken leg, he called, and I've hurt my hand. I don't think either of us can climb a ladder.
Not a problem. We can pull you up.
And with that, the man tumbled a long rope ladder over the side of the ship. Tristram caught at it with his good hand, and he held it steady, while Yvaine pulled herself onto it, and he climbed on below her. The face vanished from the side of the ship, as Tristram and Yvaine dangled awkwardly on the end of the rope ladder. The wind caught the skyship, causing the ladder to pull up from the cloud, and Tristram and Yvaine to spin slowly in the air.
"Now haul!"
shouted several voices in unison, and Tristram felt them being hauled up several feet.
"Haul! Haul! Haul!"
Each shout signaled them being pulled higher. The cloud upon which they had been sitting was now no longer below them. Instead, there was a drop of what Tristram supposed must be a mile or more. He held on tightly to the rope, hooking the elbow of his burned hand about the rope ladder. Another jerk upwards, and Yvaine was level with the top of the ship's railing. Someone lifted her with care and placed her upon the deck. Tristram clambered over the railing himself and tumbled down onto the oaken deck. The ruddy-faced man extended a hand.
"Welcome aboard," he said. "This is the free ship Perdita, bound on a lightning-hunting expedition. Captain Johannes Alberic, at your service."
He coughed deep in his chest. And then, before Tristram could say a word in reply, the captain spied Tristram's left hand and called,
"Maggot! Maggot, blast you! Where are you? Over here. Passengers in need of attention. There, lad. Maggot'll see to your hand. We eat at 6 bells. You shall sit at my table."
Soon a nervous-looking woman with an explosive mop of carrot-red hair, Maggot, was escorting him below decks and smearing a thick green ointment onto his hand, which cooled it and eased the pain. And then he was being led into the mess, which was a small dining room next to the kitchen, which he was delighted to discover they referred to as the galley, just as in the sea stories he had read. Tristram did, indeed, get to eat at the captain's table, although there was, in fact, no other table in the mess. In addition to the captain and Maggot, there were 5 other members of the crew, a disparate bunch, who seemed content to let Captain Alberic do all the talking, which he did, with his ale pot in one hand and the other hand alternately concerned with holding his stubby pipe and conveying food into his mouth. The food was a thick soup of vegetables, beans and barley, and it filled Tristram and contented him. To drink, there was the clearest, coldest water Tristram had ever tasted. The captain asked them no questions about how they came to find themselves high on a cloud, and they volunteered no answers. Tristram was given a berth with Oddness, the first mate, a quiet gentleman with large wings and a bad stammer, while Yvaine berthed in Meggett's cabin, and Meggett herself moved into a hammock. Tristram often found himself looking back on his time on the Perdita during the rest of his journey through Faerie as one of the happiest periods of his life. The crew let him help with the sails and even gave him a turn at the wheel from time to time. Sometimes the ship would sail above dark storm clouds, as big as mountains, and the crew would fish for lightning bolts with a small copper chest. The rain and the wind would wash the deck of the ship, and he often would find himself laughing with exhilaration while the rain ran down his face and gripping the rope railing with his good hand to keep from being tumbled over the side by the storm. Maggot, who was a little taller and a little thinner than Yvaine, had lent her several gowns, which the star wore with relief, taking pleasure in wearing something new on different days. Often she would climb out to the figurehead, despite her broken leg, and sit, looking down at the ground below.
"How's your hand?" asked the captain.
"A lot better, thank you," said Tristram. The skin was shiny and scarred, and he had little feeling in the fingers, but Meggett's salve had taken most of the pain and sped the healing process immeasurably. He had been sitting on deck, with his legs dangling over the side, looking out.
"We'll be taking anchor in a week to take provisions and a little cargo," said the captain. "Might be best if we were to let you off down there."
"Oh, thank you," said Tristram.
"You'll be closer to Wall. Still a good 10-week journey, though,"
maybe more. But Meggett says she's nearly got your friend's leg up to snuff. It'll be able to take her weight again soon.
They sat side by side. The captain puffed on his pipe. His clothes were covered in a fine layer of ash. And when he was not smoking his pipe, he was chewing at the stem, or excavating the bowl with a sharp metal instrument, or tamping in new tobacco.
"You know," said the captain, staring off toward the horizon, "it wasn't entirely fortune that we found you." "Well, it was fortune that we found you. But it'd also be true to say that I was keeping half an eye out for you, I and a few others about the place."
"Why?" said Tristram. "And how did you know about me?" In reply, the captain traced a shape with his finger and the condensation on the polished wood.
"It looks like a castle," said Tristram.
The captain winked at him.
"Not a word to say too loudly," he said, "even up here. Think of it as a fellowship."
Tristram stared at him. "Do you know a little hairy man with a hat and an enormous pack of goods?" The captain tapped his pipe against the side of the boat. A movement of his hand had already erased the picture of the castle.
"Aye, and he's not the only member of the fellowship with an interest in your return to war. Which reminds me, you should tell the young lady that if she fancies trying to pass for other than what she is, she might try to give the impression that she eats something, anything, from time to time."
"I never mentioned war in your presence," said Tristram. "When you asked where I came from, I said, 'Behind us.' And when you asked where we were going, I said, 'Ahead of us.'"
"That's my boy," said the captain. "Exactly."
Another week passed, on the fifth day of which Meggett pronounced Yvain's splint ready to come off. She removed the makeshift bandages and the splint, and Yvain practiced hobbling about the decks from bow to stern, holding onto the rails. Soon she was moving about the ship without difficulty, albeit with a slight limp. On the sixth day, there was a mighty storm, and they caught 6 fine lightning bolts in their copper box. On the seventh day, they made port. Tristram and Yvain said their goodbyes to the captain and the crew of the free ship Perdita. Meggett gave Tristram a small pot of the green salve for his hand and for Yvain to rub onto her leg. The captain gave Tristram a leather shoulder bag filled with dried meats and fruits and fragments of tobacco, a knife and a tinderbox.
"Oh, it's no bother, lad. We're taking on provisions here anyway."
While Meggett made Yvain a gift of a blue silk gown sewn with tiny silver stars and moons.
"For it looks so much better on you than it ever has on me, my dear."
The ship moored beside a dozen other similar sky ships at the top of a huge tree, large enough to support hundreds of dwellings built into the trunk. It was inhabited by people and dwarfs, by gnomes and sylvans and other, even queerer folk. There were steps around the trunk, and Tristram and the star descended them slowly. Tristram was relieved to be back on something attached to solid ground, and yet, in some way he could never have put into words, he felt disappointed. As if, when his feet touched the earth once more, he'd lost something very fine. It was 3 days of walking before the harbour tree disappeared over the horizon. They travelled west toward the sunset along a wide and dusty road. They slept beside hedgerows. Tristram ate fruit and nuts from bushes and trees, and he drank from clear streams. They encountered few other people on the road. When they could, they stopped at small farms, where Tristram would put in an afternoon's work in exchange for food and some straw in the barn to sleep upon. Sometimes they would stop in the towns and villages upon the way to wash and eat, or in the star's case, to feign eating, and to room, whenever they could afford it, at the town's inn. In the town of Simcock Underhill, Tristram and Yvain had an encounter with a goblin press gang that might have ended unhappily, with Tristram spending the rest of his life fighting the goblins' endless wars beneath the earth, had it not been for Yvain's quick thinking and her sharp tongue. In Berinhead's forest, Tristram outfaced one of the great tawny eagles, who would have carried them both back to its nest to feed its young, and was afraid of nothing at all, save fire. In a tavern in Falkestone, Tristram gained great renown by reciting from memory Coleridge's Kubla Khan, the 23rd Psalm, the Quality of Mercy speech from The Merchant of Venice,
and a poem about a boy who stood on the burning deck where all but he had fled, each of which he had been obliged to commit to memory in his school days. He blessed Mrs. Cherry for her efforts in making him memorize verse until it became apparent that the townsfolk of Folkston had decided that he would stay with them forever and become the next bard of the town. Tristram and Yvain were forced to sneak out of the town at the dead of night, and they only escaped because Yvain persuaded, by some means on which Tristram was never entirely clear, the dogs of the town not to bark as they left. The sun burnt Tristram's face to a nut-brown colour and faded his clothes to the hues of rust and of dust. Yvain remained as pale as the moon, and she did not lose her limp, no matter how many leagues they covered. One evening, camped at the edge of a deep wood, Tristram heard something he had never heard before. A beautiful melody, plangent and strange. It filled his head with visions and filled his heart with awe and delight. The music made him think of spaces without limits, of huge crystalline spheres which revolved with unutterable slowness through the vasty halls of the air. The melody transported him, took him beyond himself. After what might have been long hours and might have been only minutes, it ended, and Tristram sighed. "That was wonderful," he said. The star's lips moved involuntarily into a smile, and her eyes brightened. "Thank you," she said. "I suppose that I have not felt like singing until now." "I have never heard anything like it." "Some nights," she told him, "my sisters and I would sing together, sing songs like that one, all about the lady our mother and the nature of time and the joys of shining and of loneliness." "I'm sorry," he said. "Don't be," she told him. "At least I am still alive. I was lucky to have fallen in fairy, and I think I was probably lucky to have met you."
"Thank you," said Tristram.
"You're welcome," said the star. She sighed then, in her turn, and stared up at the sky through the gaps in the trees. Tristram was looking for breakfast. He had found some young puffball mushrooms and a plum tree covered with purple plums which had ripened and dried almost to prunes when he spotted the bird in the undergrowth. He made no attempt to catch it. He had had a severe shock some weeks earlier when, having narrowly failed to capture a large grey-brown hare for his dinner, it had stopped at the edge of the forest, looked at him with disdain and said, "Well, I hope you're proud of yourself, that's all," and had scampered off into the long grass. But he was fascinated by it. It was a remarkable bird, as large as a pheasant, but with feathers of all colours, garish reds and yellows and vivid blues. It looked like a refugee from the tropics, utterly out of place in this green and ferny wood. The bird started in fear as he approached it, hopping awkwardly as he came closer and letting out cries of sharp distress. Tristram dropped to one knee next to it, murmuring reassurances. He reached out to the bird. The difficulty was obvious. A silver chain attached to the bird's foot had become entangled in the twisted stub of a jutting root, and the bird was caught there by it, unable to move. Carefully, Tristram unwound the silver chain, unhooking it from the root, while stroking the bird's ruffled plumage with his left hand. "There you go," he said to the bird. "Go home." But the bird made no move to leave him. Instead, it stared into his face, its head cocked on one side. "Look," said Tristram, feeling rather odd and self-conscious. "Someone will probably be worried about you." He reached down to pick up the bird. Something hit him then, stunning him. Although he had been still, he felt as if he had just run at full tilt into an invisible wall. He staggered and nearly fell.
"Thief!" shouted a cracked old voice. "I shall turn your bones to ice and roast you in front of a fire. I shall pluck your eyes out and tie one to a herring and t'other to a seagull, so the twin sights of sea and sky shall take you into madness. I shall make your tongue into a writhing worm, and your fingers shall become razors, and fire ants shall itch your skin, so each time you scratch yourself..."
"There is no need to belabour your point," said Tristram to the old woman. "I did not steal your bird. Its chain was snagged upon a root, and I had